Quick math, beauties. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything just costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Jillian. That's netsuite.com/Jillian. netsuite.com/Jillian.
When you need to refuel between meetings or running errands, or you just want a healthy snack that squashes your hunger, Wonderful Pistachios, which come in a variety of flavors and sizes, by the way, are the perfect choice to fill you up and keep you going throughout the day. Wonderful Pistachios is also a good source of protein and a zero guilt snack. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, guys, which gives you over 10% of your daily value. And with flavors like salt and pepper, sweet chili, and seasoned salt in the shelled variety, options like chili roasted, sea salt, and vinegar or jalapeno lime in the no shell variety, you're sure to please your taste buds while snacking healthy. So check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day.
Oh Lord.
Well, we don't usually start the show with an interview, but we have our very favorite doctor on with us because we felt this was an important time to do this. So Jill, take it on.
Dr. Kati Van Hurley is with us today. You all know her, you all love her. Dr. V, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. Thanks, you guys.
And Dr. V is really busy, guys. She jumped literally out of her clinic for 10 minutes to talk to us about Ebola. And I don't want to perpetuate fear, but I'll be honest. I think we're all a little bit scared, and it's jumping borders. And we have our, I think, 2 cases in the U.S. One guy died. Now it's in Spain. And, I mean, Dr. V, okay, first question is, is this a real concern, or is this being inflamed by the media? Do we need to worry about this or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important. That's the start of the whole conversation. First of all, any kind of communicable disease, meaning one that you can pass on, is something, as a public health person myself, by the way, it's really important we are educated. So the majority of how people do well in every way in their life is through health education.
Okay.
So any doctor that tells you that they don't have time to go through things, God bless them, they may not have time, but that's going to be the way that we all stay and maintain good health. Mm-hmm. So is this important? Yes, it's important. Do we have to panic? No, we shouldn't panic. And have we seen outbreaks of different kind of viral or bacterial diseases before that the public health agencies around the world, World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, CDC, in this country, have been able to curb and maintain? Yes, we have. We know how to do this, so I don't think we should panic, but I do think it's really important, and that's why I stepped away from my clinic, quite frankly, to get on the call. I think we need to educate ourselves.
Now, okay, I've read different things, and this is where I'm really confused, because I've read, oh, it's very hard to get, and you can only get it through bodily fluids, and then I read somewhere else that there were some cases they don't think were transferred through bodily fluids, and then I read that it could mutate, and then I read, oh, no, it can't mutate fast enough, and I don't know what the heck's going on. How do we catch this thing?
Right. So really great questions. I'm going to go all the way to the end one about mutation.
Okay.
So viruses, we know notoriously, as well as bacteria, can become for instance, resistant to medications, especially bacteria, okay. and viruses can mutate. We know that this is part of the life cycle for many viruses and bacteria, that what they want to do is continue to live. And if the human becomes a host, meaning that they live inside of a person, right. then they will do everything at all possible for all possible causes to live. So mutation has not been documented that I've seen, okay. but again, we don't know yet. Now, in terms of how it spreads, and that's the education portion that's so important, we know it's animal-borne. It was thought to be really in like the bush animals and so forth of Western Africa. And what we really have heard and seen more of, and this was discovered many years ago, actually, Ebola, the virus, in I think it was 1976, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, a long time ago. And what we understood and then and now is that it can live in almost any bodily fluid. So that means in tears, that means in vaginal secretions,
sweat.
That means in semen, sperm, that means obviously in blood, that means in sweat, and so forth. So one of the big things, if there is somebody that has traveled from the areas in Western Africa that, let's say, has a fever or is starting to not feel well, and even with that kind of travel, right now, with the incubation period that we know, which is between 2 and 21 days that this virus is trying to do its best to live inside that human and spread,
right.
I would be very careful, me personally and as a clinician, with all the body fluids, all of them. So are we talking about that this can't be spread if you don't touch somebody? And I think that's what you're trying to get at.
Quite honestly, yeah. Like if I'm at the gym and somebody's sweating on the treadmill, then I get on their treadmill and I touch the handrails and they drip sweat on there. Could I get Ebola if they had it?
Right. And so it's not a hugely robust virus. Like some viruses can live on countertops for weeks.
Okay.
This one apparently can't for so long, although I've seen some reported information that, for instance, it can live for 3 months in semen. In ejaculate. So that tells me that sweat, where we know it can live in sweat, in any kind of perspiration, you know, on your treadmill,
right.
you may have a chance, quite frankly, if it is wet enough that you can pick that up,
okay.
that virus from that sweat, yes, there's a possibility that you may contract Ebola. Now, I think something that's really important that keeps going being mentioned is it's not a breathable virus, meaning it's not through respiratory transfer. You can't breathe on someone and get it.
Okay.
The one thing that I am asking really as a clinical question myself, and I've talked to my colleagues about this and we're all mulling over it, is that we know that when we breathe, there are microscopic respiratory droplets, meaning
right.
that there are really little bits of, it's not sweat, we call it insensible losses. And when we breathe, if it truly can live in all elements of our bodily fluids, could you possibly transfer it in a respiratory droplet, let alone like a cough or a sneeze? If any of us have seen those famous pictures that I think we've talked about on this show before of a sneeze or a cough, you don't see anything. But if you look at those timed elapsed pictures, it's a huge tornado spray of wetness, actually. You know what I'm talking about, Rachel.
I've seen the sneezes in slow motion, and it's like just, or a cough, and you just see germs fly everywhere. I've seen it.
There you go. So could it be from sweat? Yeah, I think at this point, I would personally say the better part of valor is to assume that on that treadmill, it could be from the sweat. Now, what does it mean? Does it mean you don't touch anyone or anything anymore? Well, if you're in the healthcare profession, if you're in the public health realm where you're seeing patients who come in with fevers, who have had travel history, who have had exotic travel history, and by the way, the universal precautions we all do in healthcare really stand true.
I was going to ask you about that. That was going to be one of my next questions was what precautions should we take? So I'm sorry, please go on.
Yeah. So one of the things, Jillian, that is quite important, and again, I talked to some of my colleagues, and folks were saying, gosh, where normally you might give your patient a hug or a handshake, and you might, not think twice about going to the market and wiping down, you know, with the little wipe that they do, the fanny wipe, yep. and maybe bringing your Purell.
Yeah.
Maybe you were thinking before not to do that. Well, this might be a time that you want to
extra
think
okay.
about doing that. We don't live in any of what we call the endemic regions. We also aren't, in general, part of areas that have been looked at of spread. Where you might say, and I only say might say, not to instill panic, but where we might say patients do potentially have to be careful is if you're living or working at airports, big hubs. And I'm going to be honest. Look, these patients, some of them go through the big Brussels airports in Belgium, in London. They travel through some of, as we know, the Washington airports or Chicago O'Hare. So let's just think of, okay, what are the big hubs of folks that could be coming through, and do we have to be extra careful? Sure. If you saw a patient, not a patient, but a person, let's say, that was sweating, nervous, looks ill, coughing, just like I say, and we've seen this with the avian flu virus, we've seen it with meningitis, which is a bacteria, do you treat them like, sorry to say this, lepers? Do you stay completely away
right,
from them and not
of course.
Help someone? Well, no, but should you be careful right now until we know more? Yes,
yeah.
I think it's prudent to be careful. I also want to add something else, Jillian, and that is if you are a patient that is immunocompromised, if you have an autoimmune disease, let's say you have lupus, let's say that you have something that we know drags your immune system down already, a cancer, hepatitis, something else that is already ongoing, and especially if you're on medications that immunosuppress, the different agents we give to our organ transplant patients, the steroids, being on any kind of steroid medications, anything that might already immunocompromise you, we have to be very careful. One thing that we know, for instance, is if you take, let's say, our liver or kidney transplant patients, we tell them for quite a long period of time, while we put them on these different medications, including steroids, so that we know that that organ can graft or grow in them in a healthy way, we tell them, don't go to shopping malls, don't shake hands with people, don't have guests at home, don't go to movie theaters, and if you do, you wear a mask. Those masks are actually not to protect you from what they have, that's actually to protect them from what we all have. And it's not to say we have to all walk around in panic or fear,
okay.
but I do agree, Jillian, we need to be aware. Until we hear more, we need to be aware.
All right. Dr. V, I know you need to go. Do you have time for one more question? Or do you
I sure do. I have time for one more question. Thank you, Jillian.
Okay. I'm torn, so I'm going to give you both. You answer the one you think is best. The first
okay.
one is it contagious before it manifests? Second one is, do we have any sort of treatment or cure?
You've asked the two multi-million dollar questions here, and I have to answer them both because you're reading my mind. And I've gone back and forth with some of my expert colleagues and scientists regarding this 2 to 21 day incubation period. Incubation periods for different diseases are defined differently. So as I was saying, this virus particularly is trying to replicate and live within the host, the human being that contracted it. And between 2 and 21 days, it can actually start mounting illness if it can be successful in replicating and building up its number, right, in the person.
Right.
And the question is, and there's no good answer that I've heard yet, is that you are not infectious per se if you don't have a fever. Now, the way the public health organizations are describing it, which is the way we've looked at a lot of other diseases, is you can transmit it once during that incubation period. There is a fever or first signs of those symptoms
okay.
of muscle aches and so forth, and again, the fever and the nausea, maybe even bleeding disorders. So okay. then at that fever time, that time that you are actually as a host sick, that's when you transmit it.
Got it.
However, I'm going to throw in, again, not for panic, but the caveat, but wait a minute. If that virus is replicating and trying to get to the fever days in that incubation period, is it not transmissible? That I don't have a good answer for.
Okay.
Number two, so I'd still say universal precautions, you guys. If someone has said that they are coming from an area that they have been either in helping in Western Africa or otherwise, or have been around patients with flus and viruses that haven't been well understood from patients in those endemic areas, I think you've got to use the same precautions, whether those folks have a fever or not, between the 2 and 21 days. And that's part of that isolation that the CDC, I think, has asked, for instance, the family of one of the cases in Dallas, right?
Yes.
To be in isolation. Because I think the answer, and I don't want to surmise, is we don't actually know if these folks don't have a fever, are they still contagious? Treatment. Some people talk about prevention, and we can talk about the antiviral simple things, even like Tamiflu. We don't have great treatments. The one company that had the ZMAP agent, and now there's a couple of other agents, they ran out of it, as you know. I think that's all over the news.
It is.
Hard. It comes from the tobacco plant, and it's a hard medication to cultivate. That seemed to have some benefit, but only in a very few set of very famous cases now. So do we know if that's going to be an actual treatment? Only a well randomized controlled study will show us that. But at least we are hopeful for that. Standard treatments that we have really aren't, let's say, curative and certainly haven't been tested. So what's the best thing? The precautions. Exactly why I'm getting on this call and why you're asking me today and why you called this morning and said, you know, Katya, can you get on? Because it's going to be prevention. Every step that we can take, not out of fear and paranoia, but to actually protect those around us, warn those, you know, if you have a fever or a cold, just go get yourself checked. By the way, get yourself checked to make sure it's not enterovirus, that it's not a flu. Kind of put it in that same realm right now.
Okay.
This is something we should take care of every day. And that's really the cornerstone of public health education, and I think of overall wellness.
Dr. V, thank you so much. How can people find you if they, because you're the world's best doctor, as long as you still make time for me? How can they?
I don't know about that, but vanherle3@AOL.com. VanHerle, the number 3@AOL.com.
Thank you so much, Dr. V. I know you're very busy. Please go be
thank
the best
you guys.
Doctor
thank
ever.
Thank you so much.
We worship and adore you. Thank you.
Thank you. Be safe. Thank you. Goodbye.
Gosh, okay. I was kind of hoping she was going to tell me this was blown out of proportion. I was really hoping she was going to say, no, there's not a lot to worry about. And I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a conversation this morning on the way here. I just,
man.
It's just like, what, like it just seems like such an archaic, old, it's like.
Plagues are
historical, yeah, like the
man.
Plagues. It's like,
it's just,
oh, my God.
But it's honestly, I hate to say this. This is going to sound so disgusting and awful. But again, if you look at the planet, I've heard that the planet is equipped to support 3 billion people. We're now 7 billion people, rapidly on our way to becoming 10 billion people. You got to think if there's a system of checks and balances, planet is going to find a way to thin us out. We're humans, but if you look at what we're doing, the planet looks at us as a pest. We're a plague on the planet. Like, we are destroying our planet. We are. Our waste and what we're doing to the planet, we're destroying the planet. So you got to think, I mean, nature's going to find a way. And it is, slowly. It's slowly finding a way. So even like you've got, and this is not, I always thought, and what I had always heard was, the next big plague, so to speak, was going to be bacteria that have grown resistant to antibiotics. And a big...
Which, in a way,
is very real.
Yeah.
Methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, MRSA, things of that. Like, it's becoming a huge concern, and there are a host of reasons for this. I think Dr. V even did a segment for us on this one. A big part of it is... You're exposing all these bacteria. We're being overprescribed antibiotics.
Yes.
People aren't finishing the antibiotics. The antibiotics that they're using in factory farming, and bacteria are evolving at a very rapid pace because of their exposure to these antibiotics. They're building up immunities to them. And I thought it was going to come from there. I really did. And who knows? Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But I think Dr. V said it best. Now, I hate fear mongering. I'm not into it. And, you know, I've got to tell you that I've grown very distrustful of the media because it's always things like, oh, Y2K, 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 the world's going to collapse and civilization as we know it's going to shut down, and it ticks over from 1999 to the year 2000 without so much as a friggin' computer freeze. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I'm always like, oh, sure, all right. And it always seems like the media is blowing things out of proportion and fear mongering. And, you know, you're always like, right. And it's like, oh my God, it's going to be the worst storm ever. And it's like sprinkling in California, things like that. But, yeah. you know, the truth of the matter is there are things that are real serious threats. And this is obviously one of them right now. And so it's
just hard. It's hard to comprehend. Yeah.
Dude, it's a matter of time. It's plane hopping, obviously. And, you know, then I read something because you would think the natural thing to do would be to put a travel ban. And I was trying to understand why the Obama administration won't put a travel ban. But then they said, well, the borders in Africa are weak anyway, and someone's going to get out of there, out of those countries into another country and then just fly from that country. And then they're going to lie to us and be less inclined to say, yeah, I was in Sierra Leone or
exactly.
I was wherever. And I was like, you know, that does make sense. And they're like, the key is to put our resources into containing it in Africa. I think the bottom line is exactly what Dr. V said is prevention, be smart, be careful. Maybe, you know, as toxic as that Purell stuff is or whatever, you know, it's time to travel with a little hand sanitizer, wipe down your shopping cart, wipe down that sweaty spin bike at the gym, and just be safe.
Yeah.
Be safe, man. Be safe, and be especially safe in I'm just thinking about how much travel I do. I'm like, okay, I'll be in JFK at the end of the week. We'll be in Heathrow in January. We'll be in Sydney, Australia, coming next week. So, oh, yeah. Just careful.
Yeah.
But she said, just be careful. Don't be paranoid, but be smart. Mm-hmm. I think that's the key. Take it seriously. All right, I got a snappy for you.
All right.
Okay, so this one is from Men's Health, and I thought it was good because I think we've all been here, and it was talking about ways to relieve a side stitch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to get better about this. This is my bad because we're always referencing different articles. Sometimes it's hard because there are many different sources. But this is from a guy named Brian Dalek. That we're taking inspiration. And I have to mention a registered dietitian that we took a quote from named Laura Schofield on a carb piece that we did
okay.
a couple weeks back. Yep. So my bad. I've got to get better in doing this. I've been remiss. So Brian Dalek, here we go. Four ways to relieve a side stitch. Diaphragm spasm. So you know what this means. When you're running and you get that, like, debilitating cramp in your side. And let me tell you, I have read everything under the sun on this one, from it's pockets of gas, take charcoal pills, it's a mineral problem, you need more potassium in your diet. Oh, it's because you're dehydrated. Oh, it's because of the way that you're running and you're not breathing the right way. And to be fair, there are many different theories about this.
Okay.
And I've tried them all. So I thought this was interesting. One of the suggestions is that you could be having a diaphragm spasm. And the diaphragm is a muscle. It expands and it contracts when you breathe. And the theory is that if you're new to running, that you can tax your diaphragm like you can fatigue any other muscle. And these guys say it can cause a spasm in the respiratory muscle that translates to a stinging cramp. Okay, now I've heard this one before. And the theory here is that you raise your arm. So if you get the stitch on your left side, you raise your left arm. And this is because it stretches the muscle. And what it's trying to do is stop the spasm.
That's interesting because it's on your heart side. I guess it's got nothing to do with it, but that's interesting.
No, but it can happen on the right side too.
Oh,
not
okay,
the left arm per se, whatever side it is. So they're suggesting it's a muscle spasm. Well, you know how like you have a cramp in your calf?
Yes.
And you get out of bed and you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And you stretch your calf.
Do you is that what you say?
That's
oh
what
God,
they're
oh
basically
God.
Saying. Yeah. I do.
Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Oh my God,
God
it's
God,
painful. God. You ever had a cramp in your calf? Oh my gosh. The worst thing ever. You're like, oh God, it feels like your leg is going to shrivel up So really, they're saying it's a muscle spasm. Your diaphragm is spasming and you just stretch it out. And I have heard that. Raise the arm. Huh. On the side where you're getting, and that's why they're suggesting to stretch it out. You can pull it out of spasm. Now, I'm a pretty advanced athlete, and I still get stitches. So remember, there are multiple theories here and multiple reasons why you may get one. Another theory is that you might be breathing, is this a word, shallowly? your work's for me.
Shallowly.
You're not breathing deep enough.
Yeah.
And so you're not able to oxygenate your muscles enough. And that could be creating a stitch or a spasm. So what you want to do is focus on your breath and taking deeper breaths. You can extend your deep inhalation by taking a full belly breath, meaning all the way down into your diaphragm. So not the chest, but all the way expanding your belly button. Think about breathing in to your belly button and watching the belly button go out and then back in. So that's what a deep belly breath means. We think it's just chest breathing. Singers know how to do this. Actors know how to do this. So you want to take a deep belly breath, and it says, take a count of three and then blow through pursed lips for a count of two, which is a heck of a lot, honestly. A heck of a lot to think about. The pursed lips thing is a lot for me. But
hey, a stitch hurts.
Yeah, and I've also heard to match your breath. I've also, like, take inhale on when you get the stitch.
Yep.
You inhale when that leg strikes. So if the stitch is on the left side, you inhale on the left side and exhale on the right side.
Oh, interesting.
So it's inhale when the left foot strikes and then exhale when the right foot strikes. And I've taken, obviously, a couple of steps. So it's inhale, strike, exhale. Strike. Exactly. So, you know, again, it has to do, I believe, with stretching the diaphragm when you're inhaling on that left side. These are theories, mind you. Another suggestion is that it could be poor posture. So they've said that runners who've had more of a forward slouching posture were more likely to get side stitches. And the reason it becomes more severe as you slouch might be because you're putting more strain on something called your peritoneum, which is a membrane that lines the abdominal cavity.
Oh, that's not that one under in the
not in the perineum
in the area.
No,
that's the
no,
other
no,
one.
No. Okay. So, of course, breathing more deeply and holding your body upright.
Yep.
Yeah, you want a forward lean though. You want a slight forward lean when you're running, but it doesn't mean you're collapsing your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
You still have the shoulder blades back. So there's a difference between collapsing the shoulders and folding your diaphragm than keeping your diaphragm straight with a slight forward lean.
Gotcha.
Because you do want a slight forward lean. Another thing, and this is not in the article, as I mentioned, hydration is that there's a theory that hydration can affect this. So make sure that you're properly hydrated. Another one, as I mentioned, is potassium, which is not in here, but bananas are a great source. Coconut water is a really good source of potassium. Fatigue, quite honestly, if you're tired and you're run down, that's also been linked to to getting a stitch. And if it's that severe, something that I did try was a charcoal tablet when I was younger and I was running a lot, and I used to get these all the time. And they think it could be trapped, like gas could be causing it.
Mm-hmm.
And charcoal tablets trap gas. So, that one could potentially work.
And, of course, what you just mentioned, which always helps, is if the stitch is really bad, you could just lie down and touch your perineum. Perineum.
What?
It's
peritoneum, but no, you can't do that.
Why not? At least you stop running and pleasure yourself at the same time.
No, it's not the same thing.
Oh.
Peritoneum, a membrane that lines the abdominal cavity.
Well, what's the thing down here called?
Your perineum.
Oh. Well, I'm saying if the stitch is bad, lie down in a nice room with a lighted candle and your juicing carrot. And
can you imagine what our neighbors must think when she's on a jog and they just see her hit asphalt and work on her stitch?
The perineum.
When she hits asphalt.
But here you go. There's a whole thing in here on how to do perineal massage.
Really? See?
Yeah, but honestly, this is for, I believe it's probably for pregnant women because they tell you to do that so that area doesn't tear too badly.
Well, I bet you it would help with the stitch. And I'm going to
cut your fingernails short. Yeah. Prop yourself up in bed and use pillows if necessary to support your back. Use a lubricant. Place your thumbs about one. Oh, I don't want to say that.
No, don't.
Press down towards your
Bum bum.
And to the sides of the... Why did you get me into this? Slowly and gently massage the lower half. Wow, this is heavy.
See?
Continue to massage for 10 minutes.
And all of a sudden...
Oh, it says you can use a partner. Choose a trusted partner. Don't use.
Be prepared for
emotional
reactions.
Don't use the axe murderer down the street.
And communicate
Make
with
sure
your partner.
You use a trusted partner. No.
Yeah.
Don't use
the free. I'll pick up your scrap metal for free. Guy that drives around the neighborhood. Yeah. I wouldn't ask him to come in.
See, this is how we get into trouble. This is from wikihow.com. Do perennial massage. Yeah. wiki.how/do-perennial-massage.
Stop it.
Audible.com back on the podcast. Pretty exciting. Who are they? A leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. A consumer service that allows users to choose the audio versions of their favorite books. With a library of over 150,000 titles, you can purchase individual books, or for real savings, you can sign up for an Audible listener program, which gives you book credits. Heidi has a ton of these, by the way. I use them all the time. She gets so PO'd. Sorry, going on. Book credits each month for a low monthly fee. So you can download any book of your choice, and you can access it on your PC, you can burn it onto a CD, you can upload it to your iPad or any other MP3 device. It's quick, it's easy, it's fun, it's affordable for people of all ages. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. As I said, they've got over 150,000 titles, virtually every genre. You're going to find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day trial by signing up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/exercise. That's www.audiblepodcast.com/exercise. I want to talk to you guys about Simply Safe. A lot of you know that I was robbed while myself and my entire family were home. And you know something? There's nothing scarier than that. And I kept thinking, oh, I can put it off. Oh, it can wait. Yeah, I'll get around to making that call. And when I finally did, I kept hearing, you have to pay us $50 every month. We've got to lock you into a contract. Oh, we've got to drill here. We've got to drill there. And what I love so much about Simply Safe is that it's so easy. There are no contracts. There's no pushy sales guy. There's no drilling in your home. It's 24/7 protection, peace of mind. It's $15 a month, and most places charge at least three times that. They will customize your at-home security system, by the way. They've got fantastic customer service to help you set everything up. Just go to simplysafejillian.com right now, and you'll get 10% off. That's SimpliSafeJillian.com. Protect yourself, your home, your valuables, your family. Now.
All right, we're back, and we are thrilled to have our next guest on. We haven't had her on for about almost 2 years, Tara Sophia Moore. Jillian, take it away.
Oh, buddy, welcome back. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. It's always so much fun to get to talk to you.
So for those of you that are new to the show, I could run down Tara's list of credentials, which include, I don't even want to say, an MBA from Stanford and an undergrad degree from Yale. Which is moderately impressive, but I like to think of her as, whatever. I got a weekend certification from ACE, so don't think you're special, girl. I like to think of her as a life coach extraordinaire, and she's back today. She's going to tell us all about her new book. Take it away, buddy. It's called Playing Big, Find Your Voice, Your Mission, Your Message. What is this all about?
Yeah, well, I started noticing that a lot of the women I was working with as a coach and also people in my life were really playing small. They couldn't see their own brilliance. I felt like I was always hearing about their fabulous ideas, seeing their talents, but they weren't really feeling like their ideas were ready for taking into action, feeling like they were as capable as leaders as I felt they could be. And I started working with people in my coaching practice to figure out how do we make that journey from playing small to playing big, and not really playing big just by the world's definition or the external markers, but more playing big according to what playing big really means to you. And I think we each know deep down what our real dreams are and where we're kind of copping out on those. So that's what the book is about.
Now, one, I laugh simply because everybody wants these things, but we all have and struggle with many different obstacles that keep us from going after them. What would you say are some of the top obstacles you see that prevent people from going after their dreams? Because it would seem so obvious, right? It's like a lot of people have a hard time figuring out what they want, and if they can figure it out and they go, no, I really want to go back to school and do this, or I really wanted to open up that business, or it's like, well, you want it, wouldn't you, by nature, then go get it and risk it all. But you don't, and quite often people are paralyzed with all of these fears.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, I think we each have a huge, very strong safety instinct. It's the part of us that wants to make sure we never feel hurt, we never feel scared, we never get criticized, we never feel embarrassed. And of course, for almost all of us, going for what we really want doesn't necessarily mean we'll encounter all those things I just named, but it does make us feel like we're at risk of them. And so the response that happens internally for a lot of us to that is that our inner critic comes up really strongly and gives us a bunch of narratives that sound really realistic about why we shouldn't go for X, Y, or Z, but are really just an expression of that safety instinct and that impulse to stay in the comfort zone.
You know, it's funny when you bring up the inner critic. I remember when you and I did a whole segment about that inner critic, and you had me give my inner critic a name.
Yes, I remember you named her Betsy the Bitch.
Betsy the Bitch. I was like, oh, there she is again, bringing her up again.
Yeah. And then I loved, you know, it was so great because you were like, what do we do now? Do we just tell her to go, you know, like, there was some profanity there.
No.
We talked about how getting angry at the inner critic, it might feel like an empowered response, but it doesn't actually work that well. And what we have to all do is learn how to know our inner critic's voice when it's speaking up and just not listen to it. But we don't actually have to get rid of it or become confident, which I think is a lot of a misconception a lot of people have. They're waiting for the day that confidence is coming. And I don't believe confidence is a necessary ingredient for going for our dreams. I think learning how to live with self-doubt and take action anyway is the necessary ingredient.
You know, it's funny. You threw out all these things that people are afraid to experience, from failure, embarrassment. And I, as you were running down that list, I was checking them off. I was like, I did that today. I felt that today. Yeah, I got that one in first thing this morning. And, you know, do you think that despite the fact, you know, that it is terrifying to be vulnerable, the reality is you're going to experience these emotions. You're not, no matter how much you try to play it safe and live small, you're going to get hit with one of these things at some point. There's just no way. It's part of life. Do you think that the more we experience these things, the more better able we are to tolerate them?
That's an interesting question. I think probably if we're reflecting on and learning from our experience, yes, but not necessarily, because sometimes we just go around the hamster wheel again and again and again, and we don't actually, you know, get wiser. So
right.
I think we all need toolkits, meaning practices and ways of thinking about things and good questions to ask ourselves that help us deal with fear, that help us deal with the inner critic, that help us make decisions that are aligned with our most authentic self. And we shouldn't expect ourselves to just do that naturally. That there's actually a lot we can learn about how to do that well. And that's why I love my work so much, because I feel like, wow, you give people like an inner critic 101 training, and in 20 minutes, half an hour, they can have a whole new toolkit so that they don't get caught by that voice.
Speaking of the toolkit, I was going to ask you to outline a few of those tools, and I plucked a couple of chapters that really spoke to me, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about them and how people can learn from them and utilize them. And you have a chapter called Unhooking from Praise and Criticism. That's really hard to do.
It's really hard.
Yeah.
To do.
Can you explain like why this is so important and give people some tips on how to start going about it? Obviously, get the freaking book. She can't give you the whole. I know as somebody who writes books, it's like, tell us how we're supposed. I'm like, I wrote a 250 page book on this answer. I can't give it to you in 5 minutes. But could you give me the highlights?
I can. Yeah. So I was noticing so much with myself and the women that I was working with that issues around praise and criticism were really holding us back from going for our dreams. And with criticism, the issue was, you know, I don't want to piss people off. I don't want to do something that is going to be super controversial. I don't want to, you know, write that op-ed article about my story if I know that half of the comments are going to be really harsh, right? All this kind of, I have to avoid criticism. And yet on the other side, it was just as destructive for people to be really attached to praise and used to praise. And especially for people who were maybe high achievers or used to being really good at their job, that dependence on praise was holding them back from making a career transition or becoming a beginner at something that they were really passionate about or speaking up and voicing an unpopular idea. So I use this term unhooking from praise and criticism about like how do we not get so tripped up by it. And there are a few quick tools I'll mention. One is reframing how you think about feedback.
Okay.
So that you understand feedback not as telling you something about you, rather as telling you about the person giving the feedback.
That's amazingly, I don't understand how, yeah, I'm just thinking to myself, because I'm such a narcissist that everything you say, I immediately am thinking about how do I respond to this with my business? How do I respond to this? Like even the things I post on Facebook, I'm like, you know, they really liked when I posted about that. So I'm going to post about, even though there are things like I've got a whole host of things and articles that I've held on to because I was like, oh, you know, this might really upset people or they might misunderstand it, but I really wanted to start the conversation. And it you're right. You get, I get addicted to it. And even though I know better, it does become about me instead of what it tells me about them.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean we have to ignore feedback. I think from a strategic point of view, most of us need to really pay attention to feedback in our careers. It just means that, let's say, nobody likes one of the articles you post, but instead of you then going, oh, like, my posting wasn't good, or I have a weird taste that nobody understands, that instead you'd say, oh, okay, that's telling me some piece of information about what my audience resonates with. And now I'm going to try and interpret that in a way that can help me be more effective with them. So same thing if you get, you know, a tough performance review from your boss. It's so different to say, this really is telling me about what my boss expects of me and is looking for in the role. It tells me about his or her priorities, rather than just taking on, oh, yeah, because he said, you know, I'm too aggressive, that means I'm too aggressive. It's like, well, no, that actually tells you about what he's looking for. And you might want to incorporate that feedback and change your behavior based on it, but now you know why you're doing it. You're doing it to be effective in that situation, okay, not because you're riding an emotional roller coaster of ego highs and lows based on how other people are responding to you.
That's I'm extremely irritated that I haven't figured that out actually yet, which is, gosh, okay.
Well, yeah. And you know what? It's not something we'd ever naturally figure out because, you know, we're all so, our egos are so sensitive to feedback that usually when we get it, we're really wrapped up in what that experience was and it's hard to pull back.
Right. Okay, now, I'm still going, I know, but do you know how therapized I am? Like, I'm like, right, and in my mind, I'm like, no, 30 years of therapy, I should know.
One of my favorite comments that someone told me about the book, they were like, Tara, I read this one chapter, and it was 5 years of therapy I got done, all in reading the one chapter.
Yeah, it's
awesome.
Crazy, girl, I'm telling you, it really is. But so that brings me to the next one. Leave good student habits behind. God, that's a crazy statement. You would think people cherish that. Yeah. I was a terrible student, so I don't have any. But
so this is interesting, right? Because look how successful you've been in your career.
Oh, that's true. Look at me.
My point.
There's my praise.
There she goes.
Ding, ding, ding,
oh,
ding,
no.
ding.
Tara, don't feed the beast. Don't poke this bear.
But I would say, I mean, Jillian, I'm really curious what you thought about that chapter, because I think you use a lot of what I talk about in that chapter, which is that, you know, there's a certain kind of skill set that we hone in school that the school model teaches us, and it's all about preparing very diligently so that, you know, you feel like you've prepared for whatever the teacher's going to ask you on the test or ask you in class. It's about listening to what the authority figure, the teacher, wants, and then adapting what you provide based on the guidelines from that authority figure. It's about turning outward from yourself to gather information from a textbook or a lecture, and seeing the whole model of school is that, hey, what you have to contribute, what you know about any topic, came from what you just absorbed from the outside. And what's so fascinating is that when we get into our careers, a lot of those habits hold us back if they're the only tools that we can use. Because as much as we need to prepare in our careers, we also often need to improvise. And we need to look inward for information and knowledge, not always go outward for the next research project. And we need to challenge authority and become the authority figure more than we need to just adapt to the authority figures if we're really going to start playing big in our lives and our careers. So there's this interesting thing that happens where we have to add to our skill set. And because many of us were taught school was going to prepare us perfectly for the workplace, we don't always get that.
Yeah. That I really resonate with that. That I think that the only thing that I should really be able to push on to somebody else is what I was taught instead of what my gut and what my life lessons have taught me. That's incredible.
I always like to talk about challenging authority. My shrink did clarify for me, and he's like, let's be clear that you might be questioning the rules, but we're not breaking the law, right, Jillian? He really had to make that distinction for me, and I was like, right, don't break the law. Okay, I won't break the law. Because he's like, but, you know, and then he was like, try to see yourself as empowered by agreeing to go along with the law. That's your choice. But we did talk about, because I was so quite ironically, a terrible student. And I have always talked about, you know, who made these rules? These rules don't work for me. And, you know, we need to question these rules. And, of course, it is extremely challenging. And it's met with a lot of opposition because this status quo is often built on those rules. But you're right. If you want to be innovative and you want to play big and you want to make a big statement, you have to break the rules. And I think I've done a heck of a lot of that in my career, a heck of a lot of it. And it's pissed a lot of people off. And then along the way, quite honestly, after I would say 10 years of being in my career in the public eye, because I have been doing it for 20 plus years, but I'm only now starting to earn the respect of my actual peers because I'm going to these fitness conferences and I'm kind of explaining my logic, and they're like, wow, and they literally will say to me, God, I've hated you for such a long time. They're like, but I see now, and I get everything you're saying. It's true. You do have to really look inside and innovate and take the things that work for you, leave the things that don't. I think that's really important and extremely clever and intelligent. That was my, you know, to be truthful, that was the chapter that resonated the most with me, but then I was like, well, maybe it's just because I'm a crap student. Because I'm a crap student. Now, this one also was never me, so look at me. I'm getting an A on this one. I want my praise. You say women don't apply for jobs unless they're 100% qualified, and the irony is that I would always apply for things that I didn't know how to do and figure, well, I'm smart enough, I'll figure it out along the way, and my mother would be like, sweetie, you gotta do, and she, of course, would make me get as prepared as possible, which is good, but I always thought, I'll figure it out. I mean, yeah. I remember when I was like, I went to go be a bartender, and I didn't know what to do.
She opened a beer once.
Yeah, I was like, I'll be okay. I'll figure it out. I was like, absolutely. That looks like a fun job, and I mean, I did figure it out. I figured it out, but it's like, why do you think this is, and what are you saying about it?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is those good girl norms. Like, I don't want to try it if I might fail. I want to know I'm perfectly prepared. I want to be super humble about how much experience I have and I don't have. But, of course, the problem is that a lot of people aren't playing the game that way, and particularly often men tend to feel more confident at sort of going with whatever partial skill set or training they have. And so we have the ranks of leadership filled with a lot of those people and missing a lot of the people that are wonderfully qualified and would make great contributions but just don't see it. And so I did this survey recently because I was really interested in this statistic that is in the book Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, and it's in the Confidence Code book. And the statistic came from a internal report from Hewlett-Packard that when Hewlett-Packard looked at their internal promotions inside the company, they found that women would only apply for that next job when they met 100% of the listed qualifications, but men were more likely to apply if they even met 60 or 65 or 70% of the qualifications. So that was the statistic. But the explanation that was normally given of that was, you know, women need to be more confident. This is a confidence issue. And I thought, you know, that doesn't exactly ring true to me, because I know when I haven't applied for a job because of not being fully qualified, it wasn't exactly confidence. It was more that I just thought, well, I don't meet the qualifications, so I wouldn't be hired. So I was very curious if that trend was true beyond me. And I did a survey. About 1,400 people filled it out. And what we found was that, in fact, confidence wasn't the main barrier. The most common reason was they didn't think they'd be hired because they didn't meet the qualifications and they didn't want to waste their time and energy. In other words, they believed the required qualifications were really required. And the other thing we saw is that a much more common reason women didn't apply was they were quote-unquote following the guidelines about who should apply, or they didn't want to put themselves out there and fail. That was also a much more common factor for women than men. So this rule following, not wanting to risk failure, but also believing that these listed qualifications are required, believing that the rules are real versus what you're talking about, Jillian, which is sort of pushing on them a little bit and saying, maybe if I show up with a creative approach and some advocacy and some persistence, the rules are going to change a little bit.
Now, what would you recommend with regard to would you say if you've got 50% of the requirements, go for the job? Or, like, what is there a rule then? Or, like, because what if I said, well, I don't have any? So imagine I'm playing devil's advocate, which I get I get these devil's advocates all the time with my criticism comments on Facebook. So, well, that's ridiculous, Tara. I'm not qualified to be a doctor, so I'm not going to go out for the job, which I know is absurd. I get that. So what would you say to them then on when they should go forward and when they shouldn't? Is there anything they should check off the list?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to check is this a job that you're super excited about? Because, of course, you don't want to just go, you know, sending your resume all over town for no good reason. But if something is, you're genuinely excited about it, you feel like it matches up with where you want to go, and you think you could do the job well, but you don't meet all of the qualifications, then I would say go ahead and apply if you feel you can make a case for why your skill set would allow you to do the job really well. So, for example, maybe you've worked in marketing in the corporate world and you really want to transition into the nonprofit world so you can do something with more meaning, and you see a fundraising job, but it asks for, you know, 10 years of fundraising experience. If you can make the case in your cover letter or in a phone call that, hey, let's think about the core skills for fundraisers. Well, it is a lot about marketing. It is a lot about relationship building. It is a lot about project management. These are all the things I've been doing in my current job, and I can bring this skill set from the corporate world and best practices from there into your nonprofit. Like, what if we looked at the approach that I could bring to this job and how I could bring something novel to the organization, then you have a pretty strong case, and I think it's worth giving it a shot.
Buddy, you're amazing.
So thank you.
The book comes out this week. It's called Playing Big, Find Your Voice, Your Mission, Your Message. I'm going to presume it's available everywhere.
It's available everywhere.
And we can learn more from you about you at www.taramohr.com, TARAMOHR.COM. You're awesome. I cannot thank you enough. And we
so
gotta make
you.
This kind
I
of a regular thing.
I enjoy talking to you both so much.
Thank you so much, buddy.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye, Tara.
God, she's good.
Yeah.
We're still recording.
Well, I wanted to make sure.
Yeah.
Mother of God.
Well, Jake did this arm thing, and he did a very dramatic arm movement.
Who needs Tony Robbins?
Stretching a little
bit.
You
got Tara.
Janice, by the way, had an epiphany with Tony Robbins, so I've just been crapping all over it ever
She's
since she got
She's been so
back.
Mad at me. So mad at me.
Now,
I've
we
had
love Tony
many
Robbins. He's great, actually.
Yeah.
But I've had many epiphanies with you.
Of course, because I am also a genius. But I'm willing to be, I've dropped my competitive nature as I've gotten older. I'm willing to stand alongside the greats. So that's fine. You can have your moment with Tony Robbins and your moment with Tara Moore, but let's not forget who's healing you on a regular basis.
You've let go of your competitive.
Yeah.
My God, woman, who just talked about being in yoga class and listening beside somebody, and if they go lower you, instead of just going, this is my practice, this is my moment, has to go lower. You are the most competitive person I know. But you know what is good?
No, I'm not.
Oh, Julia,
I'm just better than everybody. Oh, my God.
Listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.